I understand people not wanting to bring this stuff up. Trust me, I would probably make a ton more money on my book. And I could probably market myself to the Tea Party and conservatives and do all this stuff. Now, I know that for a fact, actually. I've been rejected from doing specific things because of how adamant I am about discussing anarchism and atheism. I could just be a family rights guy. But screw it. Life's short, and I don't think it's just about CPS. I think CPS, Child Protective Services, is a microcosm of bad thinking, of bad ethics, of bad epistemology. And so I feel that if I'm not bringing up these points at the exact same time, I'm not doing my job of trying to actually take down CPS. I am batting at the branches, right, and ignoring the root in this particular case, which is why I legally kidnapped the case against Child Protective Services. In my conclusion, I make the case for anarchism. Like, I could have chosen not to do that, but why not? Like it or not, everything that we're doing here is basically about rugged individualism, because I want everyone to be their own island that is good enough to be able to have voluntary exchange of goods with other islands, where we're free, autonomous individuals that are free from this kind of tyranny, whether that's religious or whether that's political.
So I have Carlos Morales on with me today. How are you doing today?
Pretty good. How about yourself, sir?
Awesome. I'm doing great. So I first heard about you from the School Sucks podcast. You've done some co-hosting work with Brett, and I really enjoyed the show you and Brett did, specifically on your work as a Child Protective Service agent. Is that what you call
it? Yeah, it's called an investigator agent's fine.
It sounds
more sexy and like I'm working more for the law. So either one you want to use, I don't really give a f-. They're terrible people. Oh, man. All right. Not going to cuss.
That's fine. All right. That's fine. I'll bleep it.
All right.
So that was cool. And you were just on the Tom Woods show to talk about this, and you put out a book. So, I mean, really, you've talked about this so much. But tell us what your book is, and then
absolutely
tell us what you've been doing recently.
So, yeah, I was really glad to be on Tom's show, actually. It was interesting. Tom Woods is an interesting character, especially when it comes to his Catholicism. But outside of that, I mean, he's done a lot of really good stuff whenever he talks about libertarianism, freedom in the market, and everything else. So it was great to be on there. And what I talked about in there was essentially my book, Legally Kidnapped, The Case Against Child Protective Services, which you can find at legallykidnapped.net. Got to throw in that plug quickly there. So my book has to do with the fact that, yes, I was a Child Protective Services investigator. And while I was there, I saw a kind of corruption that most human beings can't even fathom. I'm talking about removing children from homes for things as simple as allowing them to play outside, for parents to choose not to vaccinate, for people who are choosing to use marijuana outside of their home whenever they're not around the kids. And time again, we're removing these children and placing them in very, very dangerous foster homes or in just terrible situations that the kids were trying to beg to get out of. The parents were trying to beg to get out of. Everyone actually involved with their real life scenario was trying to not be a part of this. But the state, in its paternalistic wisdom, decided repeatedly that they knew what was best for these children, whether or not it was actually the best, or how you decide to define that particular term, didn't seem to really matter to them half the time. So I started doing a bit of research after I left Child Protective Services. Now, while I was there, obviously I witnessed a lot of corruption, the things I already mentioned. But then I started getting into the really sticky, icky stuff when it came to the actual history of Child Protective Services. Child Protective Services, just like public education, was founded out of, you know, early 1900s British progressivism. And, you know, Brett will tell you more than anyone else, the British can be very much the evil guys of history over the couple of years. Now, it was founded in things like, you know, the principles of eugenics, of trying to proliferate a specific type of race that is free of things like savages. I mean, Planned Parenthood was founded on these kind of principles, too, with things like Margaret Sanger. So it was basically based off the idea of trying to centrally plan society to benefit a small elite class of individuals. And that's where the first, like, state foster homes were kind of proliferated. Before that, I mean, you had things like foster homes that a lot of times were really terrible. But guess what? Most of life was pretty terrible at that time as well. So once it started moving, what you had was not only did you have foster homes when it comes to the early introduction of Child Protective Services, but social welfare groups as a whole, you also had another program that was mixed in with eugenics, which was called sterilizations. And from the times of 1904 to 1974, there was about 100,000 forced sterilizations within the United States. This is the backbone. This is the start of CPS. And though many of the investigators now wouldn't exactly call themselves racists, when you take a look at the fact that black populations make up about 10 to 12% of the total population, but they make anywhere from 40 to 45% of all the foster care kids, you definitely see a particular issue when it comes to that. So when I was looking at the history, I was seeing the problems. Then I started trying to study the financial incentives of Child Protective Services. And when you go ahead and look at things like the 1997 Safe Family Adoption Act, enacted by great dictator Bill Clinton, which permitted giving federal funding of $4,000 to $6,000 to every single investigation unit, which quickly and swiftly removes a child from a loving home and into the hands of a stranger, you start to see, wow, look at these financial incentives. Is CPS basically run off the idea that they have to remove more and more children? Well, it turns out, yes. And then I started studying foster homes. And when I looked into that, I was even more disgusted because I saw some f***ed up stuff when it came to foster homes. I mean, kids being regularly drugged and abused in these places. I mean, there were 7-year-olds on 7 different psychotropic drugs. So I started studying the foster homes. Well, it turns out in foster homes, they're 7 to 8 times more likely to be physically or sexually abused. Now, when you keep in mind that about 80% of all removals are not for physical or sexual abuse, but are instead for negligence, and negligence usually means marijuana use, and then you start to look at the fact that foster kids are 3 times more likely to be put on psychotropic drugs, that the 50% will end up homeless whenever they age out, that they're more likely to get post-traumatic stress disorder than veterans of war, and they're 6 times more likely to die than if they stayed in an impoverished household. When you start looking at those numbers, then you start thinking about the fact that the majority of these foster kids shouldn't be foster kids. Well, you start to get really, really, really disgusted. So you have those different things, right? We have the history of CPS. We have the foster homes when it comes to CPS. We have the financial incentives. And then the financial incentives get cut in with foster homes as well when it comes to drugging of these kids. So foster homes are granted, or parents are granted, more money for every single child who has a specific disability. That can include mental disabilities, like what all libertarians suffer from, which is called oppositional defiant disorder, or ADHD. Which essentially means that you oppose authority. Well, guess what? If you remove a kid from his home, from his church, from his community, from his loving parents and everyone else, turns out you're going to get a little bit of ODD. You're going to get a little bit of sleeping issues. You're going to get a little bit of anger. Well, according to a state health practitioner, that kid is bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, insomnia, ADHD, ODD. And for every single one of those different conditions, that foster parent gets more and more money. So why don't we just go and zap them on a number of different medications? So, I mean, take a look at this whole. I was taking a look at all of this. I was putting it all together, placing it in my mind. And I started talking about CPS about 3 months after I quit working for the agency, and I already moved out of Texas because, honestly, I was a little bit scared about, you know, what could happen if I decided to come out against this agency. I certainly knew that after I did that, you know, I could go ahead and throw my references and light them on fire because all that's gone now. So I was looking at that and I was going, Jesus Christ, this is some of the worst things I've ever learned. And as a reaction, you know, within my own life, I like learning new things. I like learning terrible things. I like learning about how our world works. But if we don't have a way to be able to channel that aggression, channel that education, channel that information, practical and worthwhile that can improve other people's lives, well, a lot of the times you're just dabbling in outrage porn, watching a bunch of videos of people getting smashed by cops while at the same time going, the entire world's burning down and we can't do anything. So I thought, what are some ways that I can help protect people from ever having to get in this situation again? Which is how the second part of my book comes in, which is, what do you do to prevent these bastards from coming into your life and destroying you? Well, it turns out there are some pretty practical things which I kind of go into explanation of, like how to talk to a CPS investigator, what do you do in court, what do you wear in court, what are all these specific legal terms mean. So I'm putting all of those things together in this nicely tight, packed book. It's only 110 pages, although it was about 300 pages when I first wrote it together, edited it all up, and I sell it for $3. That's it. That is less money that you normally buy a beer for. Why did it go for $3? Well, it's because that was actually the cheapest I could sell it for while still managing to get really any money at all. But it was also, hey, you know, I need a little bit of income in order to, be able to deal with the fact that, one, I'm not going to have any normal jobs after this. And two, what I've also found is that generally whenever you give out anything for free, people generally ignore it. $3 is right at that perfect moment where people go, okay, I'll go ahead and give this a read, and it's cheap enough for me to be willing to buy. I also ended up creating a second edition a couple months later with the help of an editor, Turns out editors are kind of a good thing to have before you push out a book. I went ahead and went through an editor, paid her in Bitcoin, and we came out with a second edition, which also has a paperback copy, which people can buy. I think it's selling for like $8, which was the cheapest I could possibly sell a soft cover book, which is being shipped from another country, being typed up, printed, and everything else, all swiftly going into your home for a whole $8. And if you have Amazon Prime, it's free shipping. I got to say, I'm trying to deliver this message as succinct and as good as I can, while kind of breaking it down so that even people who say don't exactly have the highest education can also be able to understand this. And I did this all in part because I felt really awful about what I did as an investigator, and that I just don't want these terrible things to continue to happen to other individuals. I want to be able to fight this thing, not from some kind of political reform thing, but more in a rebellious renegade kind of matter, where we just say, you know what, screw you, I know my rights, or at least I know how to get around you people. These 397,000 or possibly over 400,000, depending on the statistics you look at, foster kids, yeah, a lot of them really are getting screwed over. And a lot of these people are legitimately good parents who do not need to be having to deal with this particular system. And there's a voice out there. And I wanted to be that voice as much as I could, while at the same time acknowledging the fact that I'm a human being who has my own problems, who has my own stresses, who has my own life, and that I'm not some kind of fallen angel here to protect people. I just happen to know a little bit more than most other people on this particular subject.
Wow, I think you answered every single one of those questions.
I'm really good at this.
In like 7 minutes. That's absolutely awesome.
Yeah. I talk about this thing a lot. I'll be honest, Nick.
Yeah. I mean, you write a book or two, and then you do 13 shows on it with people.
Yeah.
I mean, you got to know that.
Yeah, I've done 62 shows on CPS so far. So
62?
Yeah, there's a lot of weird little podcasts out there, and I generally just throw out and say, hey, I'll go ahead and do your show. I don't even upload like 90% of them, because a lot of them are on like Blog Talk Radio, where people are using telephones. People, stop using Blog Talk Radio. It is the worst form of media on earth. I can't even listen to anything on there. Telephone conversations. Folks, we're in the 21st century. Get Skype. This is so much better.
I know. I was brought up into the podcasting by Michael Dean, so I got the best audio that one can have. I've got, I guess, a couple questions about the CPS stuff, if you don't mind back to
absolutely.
It.
Absolutely. Go for it.
So my dad, he works as a director of a charter school here in Oregon. And he's had to deal with CPS here before, and he didn't. I told him I was going to interview you. I said, "Hey, I'm having Carlos Morales on, and he knows who you are. He listens to the same stuff I do." And he's like, "That's interesting." I'm like, "Yeah, CPS stuff is pretty terrible." He's like, "Yeah, I guess, but I don't know. I don't know if I really agree with him." He's had to deal with them. He says he didn't have issues with the way some of the stuff they did, and he doesn't know everything that you do, right? And so I'm wondering, like, what is your response to that?
Check my sources. Honestly, here's the thing. I did my best in an incredibly short book, and guess what? I'm not a statistician. I have background in statistics. I have some background in psychology, just a little bit. I mean, I dabbled in it in school. My schoolwork and a lot of that stuff was involved with trying to understand how incentives work and how the childhood origins of violence throughout society. And, the vast majority of the information I give out in that book is sourced. You can go ahead and check, take a look at what happens when we assume that someone with 2 months of training decides that they can understand complete deep psychology, that they know how to question people correctly, that they know how to not do leading questions, that they know how to not stick people in hostile situations, they know how to decipher truth from fiction whenever talking to a parent, that they know how to deal with the legal system and go through judges and courts and lawyers, and that they'll tell the absolute truth the entire time when they're basically running on 5 hours of sleep and got a degree in jazz music. Take a look at what happens every single time we have a monopoly of force in any single given agency, whether that be cops, whether that be the DEA, the FBI, or the military industrial complex, or the prison industrial complex. If we have seen the history of the state be a history of tyranny, violence, and force, it is insane to then assume that CPS is free from those things. When you start thinking about the incentives that are already brought up, and then when it gets really gross, whenever you look at the fact that family court, that can only exist if a certain amount of kids are being removed. The prosecuting attorney, the court given defense attorney, whenever you look at all of those people gain all of their revenue through violence and not through competition or voluntary exchanges of goods. This is the inevitable result of all of these things. Are there good CPS investigators out there? I was as good as I could possibly be. I busted my ass to try to get the least amount of removals possible. I did. I really did work hard on that. But the system that is in place prevents legitimate help from occurring, right? There's going to be a few cases where, you know, your dad might see someone who's been physically abused. That's absolutely going to be true. We all see it. And then we see CPS come in, and occasionally they can be nice people and remove them from that situation. What we do not see are the unseen consequences afterwards. And we also don't see what could have occurred besides the removal. Maybe therapy for the parent, real therapy, not the state-mandated bullshit, real therapy could have actually helped in these particular cases rather than just removing the child from these particular situations. And we take a look at legit statistics and studies on what's happening to these kids in these foster homes. You can't look at that and go, yeah, that's all right, because it's not. So that's basically my answer. Look at the facts. Look at the incentives. Look at the statistics. And then judge from there. I would never produce something like this book unless I just put editorial bullshit from a former guy who was mad, where I didn't try as hard as I possibly could to back my points. And what's interesting on like the Amazon reviews, which I think there's like 74, which is pretty good for a self-published book, is that the only like negative ones are either people who are commenting on my grammar, which I apologize. My first edition was not exactly edited very well. Or they're just saying I'm full of shit and I'm mad. And that's not really an argument, as Stefan Molyneux would put it. It's not an argument. And no one is really calling me on my statistics. And I would like it to. I would love there to be a 100-page blog post that shows me why I am wrong. And I will go out and I'll fix that. Because every major decision I have made, every single change in my life has been basically someone calling me out and saying, you're full of shit. I was an altar boy Catholic when I was 15 years old. I thought Howard Dean was the bee's knees when I was 15 years old. Right? And then people called me out on that. I had to read books. I had to learn new things. I've had plenty of terrible ideas. I believed in a bunch of different insane things throughout my entire life, and it has been through the beauty of other people calling me out on my that I've been able to change. So if I'm wrong about some of this stuff, please prove me why I'm wrong. But until then, try just a little bit to research this yourself to see what are the real issues here, because from what I can tell, from what the stats tell, Child Protective Services is a domestic terrorist cell within the United States by any rational definition of what the term terrorism means.
All right. Yeah, that's perfect. I think that's all I have on CPS. I think that's interesting.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
We got 25 minutes in. Now we can talk about fun stuff.
Absolutely. So the first video, and I don't think it's the only, but I know I'm not subscribed to your YouTube channel because I haven't come back to it since this video that you did.
Well, get on it. People, subscribe. I only got like 3,000 right now. I want more. So,
but it was. I think it was about objectivism versus nihilism, and you did it with MK Lords.
I don't think I did a show with MK Lords about objectivism versus nihilism. So the MK Lords, just so I can do a quick refresh, because I think people actually like the shows I did with MK, and now I actually do a podcast with her called the Libertarian Atheist Podcast, found at libertarian-atheist.com. And we did one episode on privilege checking. The second episode was called Respecting Others' Beliefs is Bullshit, or Why Respecting Other People's Beliefs is Disrespectful. And then from there, the objectivism versus nihilism stuff, I did that with Thaddeus Russell, Brett, and Wes, as far as I recall.
Well, yeah, you did it on School Sucks with Thaddeus, okay. Yeah. But no, I was pretty sure it was a short video. It was months ago.
Maybe.
Maybe it wasn't specifically about.
Yeah,
but you did cover some.
Yeah, I do dabble in discussing nihilism versus objectivism. I will state categorically right now. I'm sure you're going to have some questions for me in a second here. I'm not in any way an objectivist, right? I just acknowledge that existence exists, that X equals X, is X is not equal Y, the law of identity, the law of non-contradiction, and that any argument against existence presupposes the idea that there is existence because there has to be some criteria by which it is judged to assume that existence does not exist. To state that logic does not exist presupposes the idea that things can be logically found and deduced by basic information. Therefore, it's a self-detonating argument to say that logic doesn't exist. To say that identity does not exist is to make the claim that identity exists because you have to be able to identify what the concept of identity means. In the same way that to state that there are no absolutes, you are making the claim while stating it that there is an absolute in that particular argument. Essentially, all I'm trying to find is rational ways to be able to decipher what is true, truth from fact, to the best of my possible ability. And in order to be able to do that, I have to go off of certain presuppositions or axioms or first principles in order to be able to deduce what, in these particular cases, what is true and what is false. It's basically autodidactism. And if we remove those axioms, one, we're lost. Essentially, we cannot really know any information at all, which makes us susceptible to things like propaganda. It makes us susceptible to what I consider the most devastating possible idea that has ever been promoted throughout the history of mankind, which is the idea that faith is good. And faith, to me, is the greatest enemy of liberty, freedom, and mental liberation that exists on this planet Earth, and that the state and religion would collapse immediately if we would simply let faith go.
Okay, so I agree with all of that, except but I want to explore the faith thing, so I'm not sure.
Okay.
But
there's two definitions of faith that are usually given out. I'm going to go with the first one because it's the more important one to me. So let me explain first. Definition of faith is to believe in something without or in contradiction to evidence, right? You can see there why I would kind of have an issue with that. So if I believe in things without evidence, that makes me pretty susceptible to ignorance. I mean, that is actually – that's active ignorance. That's active stupidity. And in contradiction to, well, then you're actively going out of, your way to prevent understanding truth. So when I'm in a conversation with someone, let's say about the Abrahamic God, and I bring up the inane contradictions of a omniscient, omnibenevolent God who also loves flooding the entire world, can somehow is unchangeable, yet feels things like emotions, which in order to feel emotions, you have to be susceptible to change. Where the person makes the statement that something had to have existed before the universe because something had to have created something. And then I point out, well, then who created God? Once I point out all these contradictions and I show them, hey, these are all the ways Abrahamic God just couldn't exist by its own very definitions. And then even if the Abrahamic God did exist, I mean, he was a bit of an a-hole in the Old Testament. But I point out these contradictions and then their only argument to me is that while I have faith, well, you are stating categorically, I am choosing to ignore the validity of truth in order to be able to feel emotionally happy in some way. And I don't even think they're actually happy. I mean, 90% of the time, they're not actually happy with living in this kind of inane dogma. Now, when you're choosing to take comfort in its shortest term over truth, you are accepting dogma over reality. And that's what gets us the state. Because the state is believing in a concept which is contradictory to its own principles that it sets out. I mean, the state says it's going to protect your property by threatening your property. It says it's going to protect your life by threatening your life. Everything it does is a contradiction to the very things that they supposedly want to implement in all their words. Their words like social security, their words like welfare, all these terms are contradictory to the very concepts of the terms that they were derived from, because concepts are merely, you know, large descriptions of the entities that they make it up. So everything that the state does is in contradiction to reality. Yet people choose to believe in it because they are taught to as children, or was forced upon them, that the state is a real thing, that it is more than just individuals. So they choose to have faith in this particular religion known as statism. So it is faith that gives us the state, and it is faith that gives us religion, and both of those work synergistically in the worst way possible to condemn the mental liberation of the individual, because in order for the state and for religion to thrive, the individual sovereignty of every human being must be dissolved for the notion of the greater good. And the greater good, if you are part of society in order to make your own life better, yet in order for society to work, you have to sacrifice everything that is right. Well, then society itself, in their way, is in contradiction to the very reason that we decided to join society from the get-go. So this is all based on faith. This is all based on lies. And I don't think we're going to be able to propel forward as a society until we take in the bigger idea here. And the bigger idea is that it is not just the guns that make up the state. It is not just the priests that make up the religion. It is the belief that carries it all the way through. And that's why I do, you know, promote with Megan on our show, the Libertarian Atheist Podcast, why I promote something bigger, something thicker than just going against the state. It's going against the ideas that propel tyranny. And that's basically my issue with faith in a nutshell.
Okay. So why don't you think that the axioms that you follow are based in faith? Like, that existence exists. Why? I'm just
trying to go with... They're based off of things that we see within our own world. Like, I see right now in front of me a cell phone. I'm able to physically hold this particular cell phone. I can feel it in my hands. I can see the tangibility of it. I can weigh it. I can measure it. I know that there's a chip. I can actually track where this particular chip came from. I can go into my computer right now, and it can show me that coordinates of where my cell phone is right now. And the government happens to know that at the exact same time. This is all based off of reason and evidence to suggest that this thing exists right in front of me. In order to disprove it, or say that cell phones don't exist while holding a cell phone at the exact same time, is to contradict what is occurring within reality. To make the claim that existence doesn't exist goes in contradiction. So whenever we're using things like logic or trying to gather evidence as much as we can, we first off look to see if whatever concept formation or whatever idea that's being presented has inner contradictions within it. And then we test it off of real world examples, real world things, in order to see if whatever definition I'm giving it to it, or which characteristics I'm saying is attributed to it, are actually within reality. So that's kind of the separation between that and believing in an abstract deity with absolutely no evidence whatsoever. The difference is the fact there's evidence for all these things.
Yeah, but so where I came from nihilism is, you know, I was like, yeah, we can't prove anything. And then you get to the point where that's not practical, right? That doesn't make any sense living in the world that we live in.
Yeah.
Right? It's just not a useful belief, and nobody actually lives like that. So that was where I jumped from that.
Yeah.
And that's where I said, okay, if we look at things extremely skeptically, no, we can't really prove anything. But
we also cannot approve extreme skepticism through extreme skepticism.
Right.
Yeah.
And so you have this weird paradox. And
paradoxes don't really exist in reality. They're just badly explained.
Yeah.
That's like contradictions don't exist in reality. We just haven't been able to explain it correctly.
Sure. You realize that we can't live like that. We don't live like that. So what we're going to do is we're going to operate on some of the things that seem to be fundamentally true. And for me, I don't think that I can really prove my axioms. I think that's where I draw a line of faith, where I say I don't have reason other than practicality and pragmatism for believing this. And
disprove them, right? I mean, that is kind of the difference here. When it comes to faith-based ideas, we can disprove them. In fact, because there's no evidence to hold that they are true. Basically, that's kind of what our reality runs off of, and any attempt to disprove it contradicts itself within it. I can see what you're saying on that faith thing, although I do really think you're broadening the definition of faith to kind of that second definition. I'm going to hit to that real quick. There's another definition of faith where it just means belief based off of evidence, which contradicts the first one. So, like, let me bring it for example real quick. There's a guy named Dave. And Dave shows up every single day at 4 p.m. to work. He's always sober, and he's always cheerful, and he's pretty happy. So I say, I have faith that Dave is going to show up at 4 p.m. today, sober, happy, and everything else. So I'm using the word faith here to actually state, I have a belief based off prior evidence that this person is going to do what they always do. Now, if Dave never shows up to work at 4, is always drunk, is a heroin addict, and hasn't shown up to work for 6 months. And I say, I have faith that Dave is going to show up to work tomorrow at 4 p.m. completely clean and sober, and he's going to be fine. And then he doesn't. Well, I was using really faith in the first definition of that particular case, because I was believing something that is in contradiction to all the available evidence of that particular case. So that's why I think it's important to kind of separate these words. And, you know, I don't get to make up the rules on language, but I can call out bull if I see it. And I think that's a big problem whenever we're talking about these specific words, is that it's funny because faith to me is believing something that's a contradiction, and then the second definition contradicts the first definition. So that's how much of a weaselly word that is.
Yeah, so I've heard that second argument from a lot of Christians where, well, don't you have faith that the sun's going to rise tomorrow?
Yeah. Oh, my God. How many times can they say the same stupid stuff and assume it's a new argument? I'm always blown away. Like, I was running a group called Atheist Agenda for like 5 years. And so I would do these debates all the time. I mean, God, between radio shows, school debates, different orientations, conferences I went to, I went well over 100 different debates with Christians for this kind of stuff. And every single time they go, oh, yeah? Well, who started the universe? It's like, yeah, I thought that. Great job, guy. You've really stumped me this time. Ugh, it's the worst. Yeah, they just use the same arguments all the time. And I know why. It's because they haven't researched any of this. Because if they researched it for maybe, I don't know, 5 minutes, they probably go, yeah, God's probably not real.
Yeah, and so, yeah, that was my experience. I was raised a very liberal Christian. I was Mennonite for a while, and then I was 14. I think it was 14, yeah. I was like, well, I don't know about this. I'm going to have to start looking into it. And, you know, give it 6 months, and, dude, it didn't make any sense.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, read the Bible. And it's like, what the f*** is this? There's dragons? I mean, it's so silly. And then, like, and it's, some of Jesus' stuff is just really hilarious. Like, he looked at a fig tree, and the fig tree is out of season, and it didn't give him a fig. So he damned the fig tree forever, forever. And it's really funny, though, because, like, okay, the fig didn't give you a fig when it's not supposed to give you a fig. And then you're going to screw over this entire village by damning this one tree for not doing what it's not supposed to do anyway. And that's the divinity of Christ and his stories. Then you have, like, weird ones where it's like, Jesus casts a bunch of demons inside of a bunch of pigs and knocks them over a cliff. And you're like, couldn't you have, like, just cast the demons away instead of killing a bunch of this dude's pigs? But no, he has to do everything in an incredibly tribalistic, stupid manner, because that's the kind of stupid things that people believed back in the day. Because there's nothing in the Bible which is new. None of it. It doesn't explain the germ theory of disease. It doesn't explain cellular division. It doesn't explain how large the universe is. It doesn't even talk about dinosaurs, which seems like a big part, seeing as how they've existed for much longer than we have. I mean, the amount of time between a Tyrannosaurus rex and a Stegosaurus is the same amount of time between Tyrannosaurus rex and us, right? That's how long f***ing dinosaurs were around. And the Bible never mentions any of these things. So you look at that and go, yeah, that doesn't seem very divinely inspired to me. And neither does the Quran, which is just the Bible plus some worse stuff. And then a couple of contradictions in it, which allows Islamic apologetics and tolerance people to go, look, the Quran said this one thing that was okay. And the Old Testament said this one thing that's okay. But for the most part, it's just, you know, a book written in blood, written by slave owners, at least people who justified slavery, enacted in order to manipulate and control small groups and then becoming large groups of people for the betterment of a very small little group of other people. And now we have a huge expansion over the last 2,000 years where we have all these little different divisions basically arguing about the semantics of a book written by a bunch of basic illiterates badly that is filled with contradictions, and we call that religion. And there's still people, anywhere from 70 to 80% of Americans, who still believe in this absolutely atrocious book and back people like the Pope, who wears a stupid hat and says that child molesters don't need to be thrown into prison cells, but instead moved around constantly. You occasionally say some hippie liberal cool stuff. And what blows my mind even more is that we have people calling themselves libertarians or anarchists who are still vying and pushing for this inane book that is backed, has been backing tyrants since its very inception. I mean, this is some backward stuff.
But Carlos, what about the resurrection? How could God not be real if Jesus rose from the cross?
Really, guys? Really?
That's actually my favorite argument. Is miracles happen?
Something happened because it said it happened to a book, and the book says it happened, therefore it happened. That's called circular logic, bitch, and it's wrong. did you know that Harry Potter? Oh man, so this is great. I remember being in a debate, and guy was up asking me a question. He thought he had a whooper. He's like, "This Carlos guy, I don't think he's really an atheist. I mean, he talks badly about God, and he says all these terrible things about Jesus." That was his argument. So my response was, you know Voldemort, the guy from Harry Potter? The guy was like shaking his head. He's like, yeah, yeah. I go, bad guy, right? He goes, yeah. Terrible dude. Evil, right? He goes, yeah. I go, do you believe in Voldemort? He goes, no. Next question. Like, it's just so, oh man, I am so disrespectful. But I'm not disrespectful of people as much as I am just bad ideas. And I don't think bad ideas merit respect. I think that to respect someone's bad ideas because you're afraid of hurting their feelings is to infantilize them, which is what we do all the time whenever we choose to use manipulative words rather than just telling the truth to these people in the way that we see it, because that's how ideas are transmitted. That is how people's minds are changed, because it's called the marketplace of ideas, and that needs to be solidified in the conversations that we're choosing to have, not only with status but with libertarians who are on our side, including all those fun Catholics who have done so much for liberty. We have to be willing to have these conversations, because I don't know what else anyone else is looking at, but we're pretty far from a stateless society. So while we're waiting around and begging politicians to lower taxes, might as well have a few conversations as to whether or not we should be believing in a manipulative tyrant in the sky.
Yeah, so this is interesting because I have never talked about religion on the show before, and this is the first time, and I know people are going to be upset.
Yeah.
And well, maybe they won't. Actually, I don't know. One of my things that I'm not very outspoken about anymore, I used to be, you know, on Facebook ranting about how, you know, God doesn't exist and how can you prove it. Now, you know, that wasn't really helpful, what I found, because if you post on Facebook about anything, it's not really that helpful. It's not going to change very many people's minds, especially with, you know, the 300 friends I had. But my question is how do you think that people should approach religion, especially as libertarians? Because, like, my thing is, like, I don't want to mess with people's deeply held faith beliefs.
Why do you argue with status, then?
That's a good point. And that's I was wondering if you'd bring that up. But so I feel like there's a difference, because I was at a funeral this week, and it was all about God. And, you know, like, I get it, right? There's a comfort in believing in there being an afterlife and a God that cares. Like, how do you attack that?
I don't
that?
Know if that's a comfort. I'm not even kidding.
I don't find it.
I know. So I did this series. No, it's actually only been an episode so far, and it's been the least watched episode, which is not a surprise with MK regarding the topic of death, right? And the finality of it and dealing with death as an atheist. And one of the things we started getting to a discussion with was, now, death is something to me that drives me, right? Acknowledging my mortality pushes me to do what I do, because I only have a certain amount of spins on this rotating convertible rock that is flowing around in space. So I only have so much time here before I go. And as a result, I'm going to work as hard as I can to change the world at least a little bit better while still, you know, enjoying life. Because for me, life is about collecting stories, having an okay time, and leaving it better off than whenever you got there. All right, those are three important things. And whenever I represent an idea or represent art through my music or through my writings or through anything else I do, I try to keep that in mind. That the most important thing while I'm delivering this message of, and, you know, pointing out those three very important things in life, that I always merge together the visceral and the intellectual and try to make them collide as quickly as possible so that I can present ideas in an enticing way, one that does call to the emotions of a particular individual, while at the same time having intellectual rigor that can back the particular statements that I'm making at that time. So when it comes to acknowledging death, this is actually what makes me do what I want to do. And when I was a Christian, life was not about enjoying your time right now and doing the correct things right now for the sake of the fact that you only have one life. It was, what do I need to do to have this tyrant say it's okay that I can get into his gates whenever I die, whenever I leave this materialistic existence? And so I was prone to manipulation. I was worried about hell, so I refused to question the validity of the existence of Jesus Christ. I was living in fear that was worse than Kim Jong-il, because the tyrant was inside my mind, so there's true thought control. At least with Kim, you're not allowed to say it out loud. But when it comes to religion, when it comes to Christianity, I'm not allowed to think it. And that is true tyranny. And when I look at Christians who are talking about, you know, well, it's going to be better when they're dead. Well, that's a really screwed up view of existence. That can really prevent you from being able to make the change that you want to see right now. Because this is all we got. Whether that's Judaism, Buddhism, Hinduism, a lot of these different religions, one, ignore the benefits, honestly, of a little visceral hedonism, of just enjoying a bit of the time that you have right now, going to that extra party just to have the little bit of extra store and have that nice little memory. Because guess what? Materialism, the earth, your body, none of those matter according to religions. They're just vessels for Jesus, vessels for Moses, vessels for Abrahamic gods, or any other particular god that they decide to throw at you. You know, Buddhism kind of teaches this idea that the material world is something that we should free ourselves from through meditation, through a horrendous asceticism that keeps us away from actually enjoying the time we have right now. Hinduism is even worse because it implements the system within. Born low. Well, God claimed that you have to be born low, and you're not allowed to go to that next level. You are a slave to God in every single one of these religions, and in certain ones, they exacerbate the slavery that you're supposed to feel in your life at the time. Within Judaism, you have basically the most racist religion, one of the most racist religions on earth. Judaism is absolutely racist because it's about God having specific chosen people and condemning those who are not chosen by God. Because it's not just the Old Testament. If anyone wants to look up some really messed up, go ahead and look into the Talmud, where it justifies the rape and slavery of children who are non-Israelis, who are non-Jewish, right? And then within Christianity, you have this entire idea of basically pure asceticism as well, and casting aside your body for the divinity of Christ because you're a holy vessel for God. So all these different religions push away the merits and wonder and love that can be our own existence for some unattainable idea in the future that we can never cast or get, but we're supposed to beg for throughout our life. That, to me, is not respecting mortality. It's also not respecting life as a whole. So when I see this, I think of this as worse than just the state. I actually think of it as worse than the state because it's mental tyranny. It is mental enslavement. So when I decide to have conversations with Christians about all these points, I'm honest. But I'm caring and I come from a compassionate, empathetic view. My point when I talk about these things is not to shame people. It's not to make myself feel superior, and man, there's a lot of atheists out there who learn things just so they can feel superior to other people. I come from a raw, brute honesty of something that I used to have to feel, something I used to have to deal with. I had a tyranny in my own mind that's preventing me from being able to really exist and question what was going on around me. And what's happening a lot of times whenever we see atheists argue with Christians is that they are mad and trying to shame themselves from when they were children. They remember them when they were 15 years old and being a Christian and go, "F*** that guy. I don't want him to be like, I don't want to be that anymore. Therefore, I'm going to rage against them." And it's also belief that people are stupid, right? So that's another thing here is that many times whenever we choose to not bring up these conversations that are so important, it's because we're worried about their feelings and worried that they're not as good as we are. Because we all held stupid views in the past, and I'm optimistic to acknowledge that this person can also change their mind, and it's important enough to have this conversation. So I do it. And guess what? I mean, my numbers-wise, it's been all right. You know, here's the thing is that I cannot convert someone because I don't believe in conversions. I cannot go inside of their mind and change it. I cannot change people. What I can do is interject new ideas into the way that they view the universe as a whole. And hopefully, if my points are valid and they test those points using their own logic and evidence and everything else against the ideas they had prior to, that maybe it will shift around their ideas a little bit more. It's important when we talk about atheism or talk about changing or getting rid of religion or getting rid of the state, that we have an ethos to back it, that we have more than just there is no God. There is no God, plus life can be pretty awesome. And there are certain things that we can go off of, or the orientation of ethics, which are kind of based slightly on those, where we can live a better, more peaceful, more voluntary life that is free from religious tyranny. And one of the big problems with a lot of the atheist movement, you know, with Sam Harris and Rich Dawkins and all the other folks, is that they have no ethos. They have no real morality. It's all relative, and it's all based off of statism and controlling other people. So that's why you have this two-pronged approach of here's political and philosophical freedom, and here's the religious dogma freedom, getting away from both of those at the same time to respect individual sovereignty. Because, like it or not, everything that we're doing here is basically about rugged individualism, because I want everyone to be their own island that is good enough to be able to have voluntary exchange of goods with other islands, where we're free, autonomous individuals that are free from this kind of tyranny, whether that's religious or whether that's political.
Okay, yeah, so that's interesting. This is just really kind of, I don't know if eye-opening is the right word, but because I'm scared to talk to people about religion. I don't like to do it because I get stupid arguments back and I don't feel like I make that much of a difference with the people that I talk to with it. But having said that, I feel like I have neglected that part of the argument, because I totally agree. I'm like, I'm 100% on board with you on this.
Yeah.
I think that the main issue with people today is a lack of understanding of how the world works. Right, and I think that the way to do that is to study philosophy and work your way up from the fundamental axioms, right? Because if you build up off of there, and that's what I'm doing with the show right now, if you build off of those things, like the law of non-contradiction, I don't want to list them all again, but off of those,
yeah,
and you get to libertarian anarchism, I think.
Yeah, you really do, because it's just based off of those first principles, which is why, you know, with the Libertarian Atheist Podcast, the way, you know, we started it up, before Megan got involved with the show, it was basically, hey, let's talk about why we're living in the world that we're living. Yes, there's some positive things, but let's talk about the negative things and why that's happening. And that's why we brought up faith. And then we just tried, you know, our best to dismantle basically the Abrahamic proofs of God, the ontological proofs of God, all these different things that people are bringing up as to the proofs of God. And then I put together what I think, if you could put this in the show notes, I did a video called You Were Born Into a Cult, Exposing the Religion of Government, where I do my best in this little 5-minute documentary type video. It was 7 minutes, but it was 42 hours of editing to make one video. So a lot of work, but my best to show the similarities between the state and the church. And I think I made a pretty damn good case as to why the statism and at least the Abrahamic religion are the notions which hold them together. The foundation are both based off faith and tyranny and against individual autonomy. And for your own show, I understand people not wanting to bring this stuff up. Trust me, I would probably make a ton more money on my book. And I could probably market myself to the Tea Party and conservatives and do all this stuff. Now, I know that for a fact, actually. I've been rejected from doing specific things because of how adamant I am about discussing anarchism and atheism. I could just be a family rights guy. But screw it. Life's short, and I don't think it's just about CPS. I think CPS, Child Protective Services, is a microcosm of bad thinking, of bad ethics, of bad epistemology. And so I feel that if I'm not bringing up these points at the exact same time, I'm not doing my job of trying to actually take down CPS. I am batting at the branches, right, and ignoring the root in this particular case, which is why I legally kidnapped the case against Child Protective Services. In my conclusion, I make the case for anarchism. Like, I could have chosen not to do that, but why not? Because everything I brought up, like everything I bring up with CPS, these are all the natural results of a state. It's not just a corrupt state. It's all states that lead to this.
Yeah, I totally agree. And this is interesting. I might have to go back to epistemology and really deal with some of this stuff, especially with the law of non-contradiction and theism.
Yeah, if you bring there's There's an old thing. You know, it's funny because, like, you ever heard of the term theodicy?
I think so.
So theodicy is the inner contradictions of a monotheistic god. So what okay, are all yeah, the problems yeah. whenever you try to bring up a monotheistic god? And what was hilarious is this stuff was brought up in, you know, within Zoroastrianism, which is, I mean, we're talking older than 2,000 years ago. I mean, this philosopher was back then talking about, like, hey, if you just have one god, there's a lot of problems. There's a lot of shit we're going to have to deal with. There's contradictions everywhere. And people just go, let's ignore it and kill some people. Did, actually, kill that guy. Kill that guy who just mentioned the theodicy thing. In fact, kill me right now because I just said everyone in here has to die. Because basically, I mean, religion has been carried out with a sword, not through peace. I mean, and Jesus himself, supposedly, if he existed, stated, I'm not here to bring peace, I'm here with a sword. And that's essentially what religion and the state have been through throughout history. I get really annoyed when people tell me that religion and the state were natural byproducts of people's just confusion about things. No, I mean, the state, for the most part, has been force. It is, you are going to have to pay us out for these particular things. And that's some natural byproduct. When it comes to mysticism, yeah, religion has, there has been, you know, animism, which was kind of the first, or at least from what we think, was kind of the first kinds of religion where it was, you know, based off of animals and, you know, sun worship. At least the sun's there, and I can understand sun worship. I mean, it gives us everything. But, you know, the crazy stuff, like the Abrahamic religion stuff, Levitican law, that's not exactly natural. I mean, it's confusion on how hygiene works, plus a just adamant hatred of women, which you see in all these particular cases. So, yeah, I mean, I just say let it collapse. And I'm going to try as much as I can to make this thing collapse as quickly as possible. I'm doing my work, and I know you're doing your work, but I think bringing in the conversation of religion is really the thing we're missing out in these conversations. I know Steph used to bring up some of the stuff, but since then, you know, there's just not a lot of libertarian atheists out there who are talking about this stuff, which is why I decided to name the show Libertarian Atheist Podcast, which is also, I mean, you know, I was like, I'm just going to be up front. This is the name. This is what we're going to talk about. If you don't like it, well, that's too bad, but I bet you're going to be a little bit entertained. I got some good production value. We bring up a lot of good points, and we try our best. And this is the most important thing with every single podcast. I want people to think about this. Are you leaving them in a better spot, whether emotionally or intellectually, by the time they end that podcast, whether it's 7 minutes or 3 hours? The most important thing whenever producing any kind of art is to never, ever waste their time. Always respect their time. And I think a lot of people don't do that whenever they try to produce this stuff. It's just a bunch of people talking who aren't even funny, who are just using specific terms to be able to shame other people. And they're not bringing anything true or comedic into this little thing we call life. And I think that's really important. I think it's important to be efficient and to be compassionate and caring and understanding whenever you're trying to produce anything. Any kind of message, especially one that is so life-affirming and life-changing and in contradiction to the domination system that we have presently in the United States and across the world.
Yeah. Yeah, I totally agree. That's one of the things that I'm working on is bringing up my I've got decent audio. It's not perfect, but it's definitely not terrible. And then also working on my hosting skills, right? Because that's a big part of it.
Well, you went ahead and you went the Tom Woods way, which is essentially allow the co-host to talk or your guest to talk for 99% of this, and I apologize for that. And when I start going off, I just go off, and it just keeps going and going and going and going and going. So.
Well, for me, I like that, right? Because, I mean, what you're saying, like, all I can say is, yeah, totally. Right? Because you say it, right? Cause, and that's all I've got, right? That's,
yeah, no, I totally agree. It's perfectly fine. I mean, that's the thing. It's like, some people, you got to egg them out of their situation. And some people, like me, basically talk for a living. And so it's a little bit easier to be able to get them out of their shell, you know?
Yeah. And, you know, I do that when I'm on other people's shows. I'll talk too much. Or if I have somebody that is a little bit quieter on, sometimes I do. I talk over them. And that's, you know, that's something that I do have to work with. I had Bill Buford on a couple weeks ago. And, man, the tangents. Have you ever talked to Bill Buford?
I've just listened to him.
Man, he's the king of tangents. And I love him for it. I love that. But, you know, it's not necessarily the best quality of a show.
Well, yeah, you got to add on. There's been a few guests where where I eliminate like 1,000 ums. And afterwards, I'm like, dude, I sounded great. I was like, yes, later.
yeah, I know that. Yeah.
Well, and the thing is also you are getting a lot of your preparation in a place that is good and bad, which is AM radio. Problem with AM radio is that you always have to keep talking. The problem with always keep talking is a lot of times the easiest way to keep talking is by going negative, because it's a way for everyone to agree because everyone hates something, right?
Yeah.
But talking about things you love or care about, that is scary for most people, because then they actually have to put themselves in a position where, guess what, someone else can hate what I like. So you get nervous in that particular situation. Then you get more and more hostile. And then you just start saying things you don't even necessarily believe because you're afraid of the empty vacuum of space and time and sound. And it's interesting. You know, it's cool having Megan on the show because she does really well on The Fiends. But I like to hear, you know, that kind of different side where you're allowed to talk for a larger portion of time without commercial breaks. Because in between those times is when you start stating some real stuff. You know, that 30 minutes in where you've just been tangenting on something, and then you're like, you know what, maybe not. That's the gold spot. That's the part you want. It's kind of like whenever someone's preparing for writing, your first four paragraphs suck. It's the gold stuff comes in whenever it's the parts that were not expected. It's the stuff that really starts to come in. But the problem is that you got to bust your butt just to be able to get there. And writing is its own particular type of hell. And if you ever want to do a show on, you know, writing a book or how to write propaganda well or how to put some of the stuff together, I would love to do that because it's kind of an obsession of mine. You know, outside of it's all the stuff I'm doing right now, I'm also trying to teach libertarians how to not write like libertarians, because libertarian writings are so boring. And a lot of libertarians will blame people for them not wanting to read their books because it's too boring. They don't blame on themselves because, well, you're the writer. It's your job. Mm-hmm. So it's pomposity that drives them, and that's a real tool move, and it's not exactly going to be able to express what we want in the world for bumbling around and calling everyone dumb and sheeple because they won't read our crappy newsletters.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting because that's one of the things that I try to avoid on the show. I have noticed that I don't really like doing radio as much as I do a podcast. I like to get on radio because I have such a larger audience and it's fun to be on The Fiends. It's just fun. But it doesn't get the same amount of challenges, right?
You never finish the concept.
Right, and that really upsets me, but, you know, it's still such a great opportunity.
And it's fun. I mean, I listen to The Fiends. I listen to The Fiends when I'm, like, working out and stuff or I'm just driving around. It's a good, like, it's entertaining enough, and you don't have to think too much while it's going on, so you can be doing other things, which is how a lot of people like podcasts. Like, some of my shows are thick. I did a full history and results of a public education in 12 minutes. Like, ooh. I go really dense. And that's how I do, a lot of my show. The later stuff, like we just did a show with Ben Stone that we did in Florida. That was a little bit less dense. I mean, it was fun, though. I mean, God, I really, really enjoyed the conversation. Anyone here who likes Ben Stone and MK Lords, definitely check that out. We're on Stitcher and iTunes and stuff. It was a lot of fun. Ben's a fascinating guy. But yeah, we did another show where we did kind of an introduction to feminism for libertarians, because thanks to some men's rights advocates and some very, very hateful misogynistic women, some of which may or may not be on certain shows that are libertarian oriented, there's a very incorrect view of the history of feminism, because the history of feminism has not always been about socialism and panties as being described by Staff and all these other people. In fact, a lot of the original freedom fighters were classified as feminists from the first all the way up to the third wave. And it's important for us to be able to get that kind of history whenever we're trying to understand it. And it's dense, and it's like 50 minutes. It's not even, it's not even short. And the entire thing is like, we go dense, we go into the ideas, we try to express as much as we can, and we try to be funny while we're doing it. And that's how I think I mean, that's how I like doing my shows. That's why I respected Brett but not School Sucks podcast so much. You never ever felt like he was wasting your time, and you always felt afterwards that you learned something new. And that is a beautiful thing, and he's continuing that. I mean, he's 6 years in. I think we're going to do a live show tonight. And yeah, he's evolved. Like, he started out with, like, here are all the reasons public education is wrong. Now he's done, you know, 1,000 different series, like, things on determinism to just, this is how you make your life better. Stoicism, what's that about? You know, all these different things. And I try as best as I can to do a similar thing, although what people will inevitably find with my show is that it's a little bit rougher. I curse a whole hell of a lot more. And I go a little bit more in, you know, extreme with, I mean, you know, Brett has a specific audience that he goes towards, and I have a very kind of radical audience that I kind of go towards. And, you know, it's important to get that nice mix of different ideas from different people. We shouldn't all have the same show. So it's good. It's good. It's fun. I love doing this stuff. I'm going to keep creating this stuff for as long as I can.
Yeah, absolutely. That's exactly how I feel about School Sucks. And, I'm going to look up a libertarian atheist.
Libertarian-atheist.com.
Okay. Yeah, I'll put it in the show notes.
Fantastic. And you can find my book at legallykidnapped.net.
Awesome.
Is there any other stuff you'd like to talk about? I know I've been talking for about 99% of this thing.
It's fine. No, I think we covered pretty much everything I wanted. This was a great conversation.
I had a good time. I got to go through everything. So that was...
I know. CPS to nihilism to atheism to...
Colin Conklin theory to podcasting to how to write. I'm an efficient motherfucker. If I'm anything, I am efficient.